And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and my guest today is Alex Bledsoe. Alex is a veteran writer of horror and fantasy novels, like the Memphis Vampire series and the Eddie LaCrosse series. Although born and raised in West Tennessee and now living in Wisconsin, Alex has a contemporary fantasy series now set in the hills of East Tennessee about a mysterious group of people known as the Tufa. The previous entries in the series were The Hum and the Shiver, Wisp of a Thing, and Long Black Curl. Today we'll be talking about the world of the Tufa and the fourth book in series called The Chapel of Ease. Alex, I think it's funny that fantasy set in our contemporary world is often called urban fantasy.
Right.
I've seen your books called urban fantasy, but most of the action in your Tufa series takes place in rural Cloud County in eastern Tennessee.
Yeah, I've struggled to find a term to encompass that, and there's just, I mean, rural fantasy gets it, but it doesn't sound as graceful. So I just say it's urban fantasy with the urban left out.
Although in the new book, we get an extended period in New York City.
That's right.
A little bit of one in book three.
Yeah.
But like 100 pages are up in the city, aren't they?
Yeah. The first third of the new book is set in the New York theater scene. And it was done that way because, you know, whenever you're writing a series, you have to balance between giving readers what they want and giving them something new. And one of the things that I can change how you get into the story. And in this case, I thought, well, instead of having a stranger come to Cloud County at first, let's have a Tufa in an unlikely place. And so he's an off-Broadway musical writer.
In addition to giving your readers something new with that setting, each of the books are about the Tufa people, but they are different types of books. You have like a revenge thriller.
Right.
And this one's more like a ghost story.
Yeah. Again, it's an attempt to sort of inject a kind of magical realism into it in a way that hopefully is unique and as entertaining to the reader as it is to me.
The magical aspect is present, but it's not the biggest part of the stories. It's more about this community of people and the political machinations and how everyone has to deal with each other.
You know, I also write a high fantasy series, and I've read a lot of fantasy, and a lot of times you will have magic so codified that, you know, if you say a certain string of words, you will get a certain result every time. And to me, that's science. That's not magic. Magic has to have a little ambiguity to it, to where you don't necessarily know what the outcome's going to be. You don't necessarily know where it's coming from, but it does affect the things around you. And that's the kind of magic I put in the Tufa books, or try to.
The Tufa people live in Appalachia, specifically this fictional county of Cloud County, Tennessee.
Right.
And they're a distinct ethnic group.
Yep.
So were the Melungeon people of Appalachia kind of an inspiration for those?
What happened is my dad, his family was from the Jonesboro area. If you go to the National Storytelling Festival and holler out, "Hey, Bledsoe," about, you know, half the town will turn and look at you. And he had told stories about the Melungeons to me when I was a kid. And the thing that stuck with me about them was that nobody knew where they came from. I was just fascinated by that idea that there could be this group of people that still exist that, you know, blend into the real world, but that also have this mystery at their core. And that was the big inspiration for the Tufa. So, yeah, the Melungeons were definitely in there.
But the Tufa are not the Melungeons.
No.
So how did the Tufa end up in Tennessee?
Well, you have to read the books to find that out.
Well, give us a little précis.
Well, yeah, I guess four books in, it's okay. The Tufa are descended from an exiled band of Celtic fairy folk, which are called the Tuatha De Danann, or actually I think it's Tua De Danann. It comes out sounding like Tua De, like football practice, if you really get it in the right pronunciation. But Tufa is a corruption of Tuatha. It's one of the things where you think, well, what would somebody be called if as a word gets shortened over time? And so that's how I came up with Tufa, which is also a kind of rock, which I did not know until the second book came out.
And they came to North America even before the Asiatic land bridge.
Right, right. Yeah, they have been here since the Appalachians were as tall as the Rockies. So they've seen, you know, entire civilizations come and go here that left no trace.
And they have straight dark hair.
Right.
Very beautiful straight teeth.
Yep.
Which would kind of set them apart from a lot of us that grew up in the hills.
You said that, not me.
Well, I grew up in the Ozarks, so I'm the little brother of the Appalachians. Now, you grew up in West Tennessee. Why'd you decide to set something in East Tennessee?
Well, West Tennessee is a fine place, but it doesn't have that cachet of mystery, and it doesn't have the opportunity for the kind of physical isolation I wanted these people to have. You know, I guess you could put somebody in an isolated swamp here, but you really couldn't put a population, you know, off on its own somewhere in West Tennessee the way you can in East Tennessee.
The Tufa, you don't show a whole lot of magic in there, but one of the things that is very obvious is their connection with music.
Right. And that again goes back to a lot of Celtic folklore with magical songs of the fairy folk, people being lured off to dance with the fairies and, you know, coming back and thinking they've only been gone for a couple of hours, but they've been gone for months. So it made sense that they would bring that over here. And also, the Scotch-Irish settlers who came to Appalachia did bring their music with them. So it's really imbued with that Celtic flavor to this day.
And they've been able to kind of isolate themselves
right.
in the county. There is some intermarriage with humans.
Right.
But still, there's no police force in the central city of the county.
Right.
And the government doesn't have a whole lot of effect on their life.
No. They're very good at staying out of the way and not getting noticed. One of the overarching aspects of the series is that it's no longer feasible or possible to do that, and they have to figure out how they are going to integrate with the world. Some people who are saying, you know, we should be open and we should do all this and let everybody in, and there's others saying, no, we should pull back even more than we did at first. And that's a fun tension to write about.
Well, and they've managed to keep missionaries pretty much
yes.
at bay, which is
yeah.
a pretty remarkable for any people
that
around the world.
That may be the most fantastic element of the whole story.
Because there's not a single church in Cloud County.
No. And I have a character who is a Methodist minister right across the county line in another county, and he's trying to demonstrate that he's a decent guy so that hopefully eventually some of them will start coming to his church. And he is a decent guy. I deliberately wrote him to be, you know, a straight-up good person so that it wouldn't fall into that trap of the cliche of the small-town Southern minister.
Their conception of morality is a little bit different from
right.
our contemporary society.
Right.
A little bit more open ideas when it comes to sexual relationships
right.
and expectations between partners, too.
Again, you know, the fairy folk are notoriously licentious. They love to run off with, you know, handsome men and beautiful girls. So it makes sense that if your society encourages that, they would also be more open in other ways. Again, it makes a nice contrast to what people expect from a story set in that region.
Humans who fall in love with fairy folk don't usually have the best of ends.
No. There are charms to protect you, but if you don't know about them and you get too close to one of the Tufas, you will be enchanted to your detriment because the enchantment never goes away. And once it's in place, there's no real way to break it.
Amongst the Tufa, there are two major factions.
Yep.
One is run by Mandalay Harris, who's
right.
a 12-year-old girl.
Right.
When I saw Game of Thrones this year with Lady Mormont, the very young leader of the Mormont clan,
yeah.
I went, oh, she's so much like Mandalay in a way.
The fairy folklore includes a mention of two fairy courts, the Seelie and the Unseelie. Again, it made sense that this group that's kicked out and has to make its own society would eventually break into those two camps, although I don't use those words. And one group is led, like you said, by Mandalay, who is the inheritor of all of the wisdom of her line of female ancestors. So she has, you know, a millennia of knowledge filtered through the emotions of a 12-year-old girl, which causes her no end of angst and problems. And the other half was originally led by a character named Rockhouse Hicks, who was a six-fingered banjo player and mean as a snake. He is no longer leading that group, and his successor is a guy named Junior, who is way out of his depth and is starting to realize it.
But amongst his people, he's one of the nicer people, it seems, or at least the least
yeah,
angry.
Yeah, he's not an overt kind of guy. If he doesn't like you, he won't tell you to your face.
And his wife is a handful, too.
We all know people who got married because they thought they had to, and everybody knew it was a bad match from the get-go, and all you can do is kind of stand back and watch and hope nobody, you know, ends up on the news.
Some of the Tufa have lived a very, very long time.
Right.
Some of them have been born more recently. How do they keep their numbers in check if they can live that long?
Well, it's the sort of thing that I don't want to lock down, because I want the stories to always have a sense that there are lots of things that you're not being told and that I can think up later. So, yes, some are the same as they were when they were first exiled here. Some of them have been born here, but they also have a very malleable relationship with time. So even the ones who were born here might have access to things that occurred way before they were born. I know it sounds really vague, but again, it goes back to the magic thing. You know, once if you lock it down too much, it's not magical anymore.
That's a Bo Kate's cousin who's the waitress.
Yes.
Her attitude toward relationships is kind of your relationship with the stories.
Yes.
Now, is Needsville just a reworking of Sneedville, Tennessee?
It is, and if I had it to do over, I would not do that, because that's a little too spot on the nose. I wrote the first book on spec. I had no idea if it would ever get picked up, and if I had known that it was going to spawn a series, I would have gone further away from anything that was actual, because, yeah, that's a little obvious.
And is Unicorn from Unicoi, or...?
No, Unicorn is just, you know, it just seemed like an interesting name. Is there a Unicoi?
There's a Unicoi over by the North Carolina border.
I did not know that.
It's C-O-I.
Oh, okay.
I think it's a Cherokee word.
Okay.
As you talk about this kind of having to reckon with modernity that they're going through, Mandalay, who is the head of her faction and the most powerful amongst her group, lives with her father and stepmother in a trailer house.
Right.
I mean, it's not a wealthy area of the country still.
Yeah. Yeah, because again, that seemed realistic. You wouldn't necessarily draw attention to yourself, particularly if you are an important leader. You know, you would kind of want to lay low, because it's one of those things that for a long time in Tennessee, it was not considered terribly safe to be basically considered non-white. And the Tufa would have been considered non-white. They would have been considered Native American or part African American. Again, that whole thing about developing ways to stay off the radar. So it makes sense to me that their leader would live very simply and would not draw a lot of attention to herself. You know, you wouldn't know she was anything other than a 12-year-old girl.
And another way to keep kind of a low profile is whenever a Tufa leaves Cloud County, and if they have no intent to come back, bad things may befall them.
Right. That was the whole jumping off point for the first book, The Hum and the Shiver, was a girl who joins the army with no intention of coming back and then has horrible things happen to her in Iraq and has to come back and figure out how to fit into the community again without giving up the freedom that she desperately wants and deserves.
And the other faction's head, Rockhouse Hicks, who you talked about earlier, he had tried to leave the county as well. Bad things befell him. And when Bronwyn came back, he resented her for getting a hero's welcome.
Yeah.
But he didn't even consider all the hell she had to go through to get that welcome.
No, he would never consider that. That would require empathy, and he had none at all.
And very few people had any for him as well.
Yes.
Now, the Chapel of Ease has a Tufa, as you mentioned, living in New York City.
Right.
So he has written a Broadway musical.
Right.
Based on a story that happened amongst his people.
Yeah.
And it seems with these people that want to keep a low profile, talking out of school is not the best way to go about things.
No, making, you know, coming up with a musical and putting it on the stage in New York is not the way to lay low. So he has drawn the attention of his people. They ask him to not do this. They give him the option to not do it, and he ignores that advice. And so, and this is really not giving too much away. He subsequently dies from what appears to be natural causes and may very well have been. That's, again, that ambiguity aspect of it there. But it could also be the result of going against the wishes of his people.
His name is Ray Parrish.
Right.
And when he passed away, I went, well, Parrish.
You're not going to believe this, but I never thought of that.
Oh. The book is actually told in a first-person point of view, and that's a break from the other books.
Right.
You've done third-person up until now. Why did you decide to go first-person in the eyes of an outsider?
Well,
Matt Johansson is his name.
Chapel of Ease is, more than the others, is essentially a mystery story. And I love mysteries, and all the mysteries I love are told in first person. It allows you to both experience the clues to the mystery along with him and to be privy to his evaluations of them that he, as an outsider, might not tell to anybody else. And also, again, you know, looking for a new way to tell the story, I thought, well, I have done three books in third person. Why not do one in first? I love writing in first person, and that actually was the easiest book I have ever written after Long Black Curl, which was the hardest. So I was really glad to have that.
Why was Long Black Curl such a challenge?
I'm not entirely sure. To this day, I don't know, but I ended up having to rewrite the last third of it in about 6 weeks because the original version just flat out didn't work. I mean, I tried everything to make it work, and finally talking to my editor, we're like, you know, we just got to throw it out and start from this point in the story and go in a completely different direction.
So why did you pick a Broadway show instead of maybe in Nashville or going out to Los Angeles for the record industry?
Again, it seemed like something interesting. I had been reading about and had heard the recording of a thing that Stephen King and John Mellencamp did called Ghost Brothers of Darkland County, which is a musical set in Mississippi, written by a guy from Maine and a guy from Indiana, so it's not exactly subtle characterizations. I mean, the music is very rustic. The staging is very rustic. They deliberately had no dance numbers in it, and I was fascinated with it. I didn't particularly like the play. I liked the music a lot, but I really didn't like the actual play. But that kind of stuck with me, and then I thought, well, what if I had a Tufa come and do this? The two shows that I read about the most that gave me the most to structure it was a book on A Chorus Line and a book on Rent. Because I don't know if you're familiar with the history of Rent.
I know the writer died shortly before it opened wide.
And when I hit that, that was when I just got a flash of what the whole story was. Because that is such an American tragedy. You know, you are on the very verge of taking over the world and you never live to see it.
And you had another American tragedy in the previous book with an accident very similar to Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper and Richie Valens, The Day the Music Died.
Yeah, I like pulling from stuff like that, stuff that's kind of on that line between history and folklore, because it brings with it a set of resonances. You know, when you think about The Day the Music Died, it brings certain feelings to it. And I was trying to both kind of recapture those and to take them in a different direction, which is why I used original characters and not just, you know, the historical ones. And the same thing with this. Ray Parrish is nothing like Jonathan Larson, the guy that wrote Rent, but that idea of, you know, that sudden death right before you strike it rich, I loved that. I thought that was really powerful. And I thought if I could use that as, not even as the initial jumping off point, but as something in the story, that I could capture that kind of emotion and that kind of cachet, then I would have something really interesting. And, well, let's just say Ray sticks around a bit.
Well, we learned that Tufas don't necessarily stay gone after they die.
Right. Having Ray kind of recur like that was a late-in-the-process idea. And it turned out to be, I think, a really good one because it gave Matt somebody to bounce off of in a way he couldn't any of the other characters.
Because haints are a big part of the Tufa experience.
Things don't go away for them like they do for other people.
Now, Matt Johansson, who is our narrator, very talented Broadway performer, but hasn't had his big break yet.
Right. And he's convinced that this play is going to be his big break. Even when he first hears about the audition, he just knows that it's going to be the thing that's going to carry him.
And so what was it like having to look at all these people who aren't working in a magical milieu and they have to achieve things in a different way than the Tufa would?
Well, you know, that's easy. I mean, that's what I do. The theater scene is obviously not something that I'm terribly familiar with, but my best friend teaches acting at a theatrical school and he writes all of their original shows – So I had him for a resource, and my editor's wife also does one-person shows in New York. So between the two of them, I was able to get a really good sense of what the scene would be like. And it's like anything. If you need an expert on something, you can find one pretty easy because experts love to talk about their expertise. So I had no problem finding people to backstop my ideas and to say, no, it wouldn't be like this, or yes, it would be like this.
Now, as the cliche goes, it's like dancing about architecture. What challenges have you found about writing about a very musical people?
Oh, that it is frustrating in a way because I can never get, you can never really capture it. It's like writing about smells. You know, all you can do is compare it to something else. I quote lyrics in the book. Some of them are original lyrics that I've written. Some of them are from classic and public domain folk songs. And then sometimes I use actual songs that other people have written and have given me permission to use.
Is that Paranoid? Was that one of them?
Yeah, that was one. Alice Peacock up in Nashville was kind enough to let me do that. If there is a trick to it, the trick is to not worry about describing the song, but you describe the effect it has on the listeners or on the performer. It's like writing a fight. You can't write every punch in a fight. It would be tedious to write and tedious to read. You want to catch the effect.
Now, Ray has written this Broadway show, The Chapel of Ease, and much like the book, there is a mystery that's behind the story.
Right.
And he refuses to tell the cast and even the producers of what's the answer to the mystery.
Yeah.
And that's what leads Matt eventually down to Cloud County.
Yeah. Again, I knew I needed a mystery in there. And when I had decided on certain other aspects of the story, this one just kind of organically developed out of it. It wasn't an idea that I got somewhere else. This came out of the material. And if there is an inspiration for it, it's Ode to Billy Joe. And when you read the book, you will understand why Ode to Billy Joe inspired the central mystery of this book.
I want to know what a family named Durant ever did to you.
That started with the nickname, the Durocks, because I knew about Duroc Hoggs, and I thought, well, what name could that be an insult from? And it just kind of backed up into Durant. So I know no one named Durant, and I'm sure there are lots of lovely Durants out there.
But the ones in Cloud County are less than safe.
No, right? they are pieces of work.
Now, what is a Chapel of Ease?
It is a sort of a branch church that is built when a community isn't big enough to have a priest, but at the same time they want to have a place where they can gather and worship and bring a priest in occasionally. They are primarily found along the southeast coast in South Carolina and the Georgia coast, just because that's where the planters that were Catholic ended up. So I'm cheating a little bit by moving one so far inland. But you can go online and look up that term and find lots of illustrations of them. And I think there's still some in existence and in use. It's something that, you know, some Catholic diocese will still build, depending on their needs.
Just kind of the Catholic version of a circuit preacher.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Matthew is gay.
Yes.
He's really worried about coming down to the Deep South.
Right.
And what he might experience there. But he finds out that there is a little bit of liberality.
Yeah. He comes down and he's open to finding out what's there, even though he's very much on his guard. And as a result, he does meet somebody really special. That was, I don't remember exactly where that came out of the creative process, but it was very early that I decided the main character was going to be gay. I decided first that that's not going to be what the book is about. And that he is going to be a heroic character, not necessarily just a protagonist, but an actual hero. He's going to kick ass, take names, and get the boy. And I am not gay. So it was a challenge to write, but not really, because as I learned when I was writing Bronwyn Hyatt in The Hum and the Shiver, you know, I've never been a 20-year-old girl either. If you create the character with enough depth in your head so that you know their personality, it doesn't matter what gender they are. You will always be able to write true reactions and understand what they're doing and what they're feeling. And I found that to be the case with Matt as well. This wasn't an initial reason, but one of the benefits of writing in first person is that the reader is also privy to his emotions. You understand what he's feeling when he meets Cece and how that develops, so that hopefully you're along with him on that ride too.
Now, with a county that doesn't cotton to Christian churches and a gay lead character, probably not going for the Southern Book Club.
Well, no. I think my readership is a little more liberal than that, and I'm pretty sure most of them will be able to follow on this one.
Matt had barely heard of the Tufa people before he headed down to Cloud County. Many people may have just heard of the Melungeon people, but know nothing more than a name and an odd idea. And so he was ill-prepared to find out what he really found down there.
Well, I think most of us would be ill-prepared to find that out. But it's almost a litmus test for your main character when you present them with something so drastically outside their own experience. You know, you have a chance to really show the reader why this guy is your main character, why this girl is your protagonist, because it's a real world changer. It shows you your existence in a completely new way, and you really literally can't look at anything else the same way again once you know what the Tufa are, because it alters your conception of the whole world.
You said you are kind of amorphous about the rules of everything that's going on, but do you have an idea of where everything is headed toward?
Yes, I do. The next book is done, and I'm almost done with the second draft of the sixth book. So I'm at least up through that. I know exactly where it's going.
And you said you're working on a high fantasy series as well?
They're high fantasy written as if they were 40s detective novels. So my hero, even though he carries a sword and deals with kings and dragons and things like that, his name is Eddie. And in fact, if you go to my publisher, Tor.com, you can find a brand new Eddie LaCrosse short story that just went live yesterday.
Does he have to worry about femme
fatales? Of course he does.
And I'm sure he gets waylaid and knocked out on occasion.
Yep, he does. One of the jokes is, you know, you've been hit in the head a little too much.
Because what is a good 40s detective without getting hit from behind by the butt of a pistol?
Right. In his case, he gets pushed off a cliff and then has a horse dropped on him.
Oh, how did he walk away from that? Very slowly?
Luck, yeah, and very slowly.
With the new short story just coming out, when would the next LaCrosse novel be coming out?
That's kind of up in the air right now. Like I said, I'm working on the next two Tufa novels, so it would be sometime after I finish those. I know what the story is going to be, so as soon as I get the okay from my publisher, I can jump right in and hopefully bang it out pretty quick.
And the next Tufa novel, will that come out about the same time next year?
No, actually, that one's coming out in March.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an accelerated schedule,
though. Yeah, it's a lot faster. It's called Gather Her Round, and it will be a monster story.
Which song does Gather Her Round come from?
Well, all of the titles come from the work of a South Carolina singer-songwriter named Jennifer Goree. I first got in contact with her, 15 years ago when I was first thinking about this idea. And when I was writing The Hum and the Shiver, I knew I wanted a dichotomous title, something and something. And the more I worked on the book, the more I kept coming back to her song title, The Hum and the Shiver. And so finally, I wrote her and asked her if she would mind if I used that. And she was gracious enough to say yes and then to keep saying yes. So all of the Tufa novels are song titles from Jennifer Goree.
And you had another couple of books beforehand that actually had a Western Tennessee connection.
Yeah. I wrote two novels about vampires in Memphis in 1975. One's called Blood Groove, and then The Girls with Games of Blood. And those were a lot of fun to write because I was alive in 75. I remember it vividly. And where I lived, we listened to WHBQ out of Memphis religiously every morning going to school. You know, all their criteria was it's popular. So you could have John Denver followed by Parliament, followed by Kiss, followed by Rick Dees.
And Disco Duck.
And it gave you just this incredibly broad-minded idea of what a great song could be. It was nothing like the niche stuff that we have now where, you know, Sirius has an entire channel for particular artists, which I don't, I listen to the Springsteen channel all the time, so I'm not complaining, but there was just something about that that sense that you never knew what was going to happen, and that everybody you knew had that same musical grounding because we all listened to that station.
In your Eddie LaCrosse series, do you use medieval ballads as part of the stories too?
No, that's a fairly unmusical series. It just doesn't lend itself to it quite as much. Although there are songs referenced as in jokes, and particularly in the fourth one, Wake of the Bloody Angel. If you were alive in the 70s or like 70s music, I think you'll get it in the first couple of pages.
What are you listening to on your iPhone nowadays?
I listen to a lot of bluegrass, and I listen to a lot of, I still listen to a lot of 70s stuff. There's a 70s channel on Sirius, so I listen to that. I've recently been listening to Dale Ann Bradley, who's a bluegrass musician. I'm a huge fan of Joy Division, again from the early 80s. And The Doors, which my wife has not forgiven me for because she can't stand them. She can't stand them or Van Morrison. And I do not understand a worldview that goes that way.
Yeah, you could have called book three Love Will Tear Us Apart.
Yeah. Yeah, you could have. But yeah, I will listen to anything, literally, because I'm always looking for a song that'll fit in a story or a song that will inspire a story. Or, you know, a song that will send me off into a kind of music that I may not know anything about.
Who are some of the big artists that come out of Wisconsin? I'm not familiar with much of the music.
Well, Garbage is out of Madison. Lots of polka.
Is it where Frankie Yankovic is from?
I'm not sure if he was from there, but he certainly is still very well known there. I'm trying to think who else. And of course, I actually have some musician friends, and they're going to all strangle me if they hear this. I am totally blanking on it. But
I remember an 80s band, I think from Milwaukee, named Couch Flambeau.
Okay.
And they were kind of an underground indie rock with a little bit of punk in there. They had a great song called We're Not So Smart.
Oh, actually, I can't. There's a punk duo out of Madison called Damsel Trash, and they have an anthem called More Drunk, Less Pregnant. And it's hysterical, and it's headbanging, and it's really, really good.
Damsel Trash, that could sound like a woman for Eddie.
Yeah. I think he's run into a few of those already.
Well, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you having me.
Alex Bledsoe is the author of The Chapel of Ease, the fourth book in his Novels of the Tufa fantasy series, and it's published by Tor. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.